This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There are a few bright lines to describe our economic status. The government establishes a poverty line. You can argue whether it's the right number or not, but below that number, you're officially poor. We almost never say lower class. Public opinion surveys suggest that almost every American, no matter how much they make, regard themselves as middle class. And then there's a range of ill-defined terms: well-off, upper middle class, affluent, wealthy, and rich. A couple of weeks ago, when Senator Hillary Clinton opposed raising the cap on Social Security payments above $97,000 a year as a tax on the middle class, Senator Barack Obama replied that just 6% of the country earns over $97,000 a year, and he defined those people as upper class. Leaving the issue of taxes aside, how much do you have to make to qualify as rich? Some people might say you're rich if you make six figures, others that you're not rich unless you own a couple of houses and a yacht. How do you define rich? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, the opinion page, and this week we'll talk with a former Middle East negotiator about the prospect of progress amid lowered expectations at the Annapolis summit. But first, what's rich? We begin with Robert Frank, who writes the Wealth Report for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. He joins us from our bureau in New York. And Robert, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And how do you define the difference between middle class and rich?
Well, if you look at the national statistics, the top 1% of Americans by income earn at least $277,000 each. A top 1% household would earn around $400,000 per household. If you measure it by wealth, the top 1% of Americans are worth around $6 million, and the top 8% are worth about $1 million. So generally speaking, in my view, the top 1% makes you pretty definitively rich in America. So that would be $400,000 in income per house, or at least $6 million in net worth per house.
That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. But what's interesting is there's sort of two realities for wealth in America today. There's the national picture, which shows that, you know, having $1 million is fairly special. And then there's the world of Richistan, which is composed entirely of millionaires. And in Richistan these days, having $1 million just gets you in lower Richistan, doesn't really get you much of a house in, let's say, New York or San Francisco, and doesn't really get you the things that most people would think rich people could afford.
Mm-hmm. One of the arguments, in fact, again, going aside the issue from taxes, but the arguments that the senators Obama and Clinton were having was she was saying, $97,000 a year, it's a big difference as to whether you're living in rural Illinois or in Manhattan. Fire captains make $148,000 a year in New York City.
That's right. Even butlers today are making more than $100,000. So it really does depend, you know, where you are physically. You know, if you're in New York or California, $97,000 is middle class. But if you're in Arkansas or Mississippi or the interior parts of the country that are less well off, that's a significant amount of money. So I think it really depends on what part of the country you're in and what social class you're in yourself.
Let's see if we get some listeners involved in this conversation. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Leanne. Leanne's calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi. My comment is that I don't think class has a lot to do with how much money that you make. I think that upper middle class or lower class, you could make the same amount of money and, you know, you could make $25,000 and be in an upper class, you know, an upper middle class kind of family.
So that when we Americans refer to class, Leanne, I think what you're saying is that we're referring to a certain set of values?
Yeah, I think it's a certain set of values and how you live your life and what kind of things you're attracted to. I don't think it has a lot to do with money. I mean, there are people who consider, you know, themselves $35,000 millionaires. But I would consider those people might be upper middle class. It just depends on who you are and where you do live in the country.
All right. Thanks very much for that. And Robert Frank, it's interesting. A lot of the ultra wealthy, the new ultra wealthy, particularly that you interviewed for your book, Richistan, they define themselves as middle class and then the sort of blush, meaning middle class values.
Exactly, because most of today's wealth, in fact, 85% of today's multimillionaires made their money themselves. They did not inherit it. And they all started out middle class or even lower. And there was a guy I interviewed, Tim Blixith, who's a billionaire. And when I asked him what it's like to be rich, he said, look, I'm just a middle class guy. And, you know, I said, middle class, you have $1 billion in your bank account. But his identity, he grew up middle class. His values were still middle class. And that's who he saw himself as is a middle class guy. And I think that's very common with today's wealthy.
And it's interesting that the term middle class universally accepted. The terms lower class and upper class both come larded with a whole lot of baggage.
That's right. Nobody wants to be anything but middle class these days, and including the upper class, which was sort of surprising to me because, you know, a lot of people would be honest and aspiring to be part of the upper class or the elite or the wealthy. But the wealthy themselves, very uncomfortable with being labeled as wealthy.
Who are the wealthy? What does this demographic look like?
Most of them are white men in their 40s and 50s, although wealth increasingly is diverse in terms of race and gender. Most of them got wealthy by starting their own companies and then selling those businesses in what's called a liquidity event. And liquidity events are the main reason why we have so much wealth today. And you know, most of the people that I'm talking about here are worth $10 million or more. That was my cutoff for what wealthy is in America, is $10 million or more. And most of them are entrepreneurs who really see themselves as hardworking, again, middle-class people who just happen to get a lot of money from selling a company.
Here's an email that we have, this from Jillian. My husband and I were amazed to realize that when we combine our incomes, our household income annually is over $100,000. We thought we should feel rich, but after our modest mortgage payment, two car payments, daycare, and groceries, we're just scraping by. How can this be? I don't think we're alone in feeling like we're doing something wrong, even though we're watching every penny.
Well, it's, you know, if it's any comfort, the wealthy feel the same way. I went to a group in New York called Tiger 21. It's kind of a group therapy for the wealthy. It's where people worth $10 million or more get together and they, you know, they share their problems with each other. And this group spent most of the day worrying about not having enough money because everything that they purchased was so inflated and was going up. The prices were going up so fast that they were worried of running out of money by the time they retired. So inflation, I think, is much greater in people's lives than the government would have us think. Government says inflation is around 6%. But for the wealthy, it's around 12%. And I think for most people, it feels like more than 6%.
Let's get another caller on the line. Now, this is Rock, and Rock's with us from Payson, Arizona.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
I happen to be an artist, and I have some galleries in some pretty expensive places around the country, like Aspen, Jackson Hole, places like that. And a few months ago, I was talking to the gallery in Aspen, asking if most of the clients they had there were millionaires. And they said, no, they're a dime a dozen. We deal with billionaires. But I had told your screener, Neil, I said, in my opinion, what makes a person wealthy or rich in that is people who can come in, and I call it buy on the spur of the moment. They don't have to think about payments. They don't have to think about what's coming up tomorrow, the next day, and that. They might walk in and buy a $10,000, $20,000 painting without batting an eye. Now, to me, these people are rich.
That is a definition of rich when you think as much about the purchase price of a $20,000 painting as you do for a pack of gum.
Yeah, they're impulse buyers.
Impulse buyers. Robert Frank, what do you think? How does that definition work for you?
Well, that is a great definition, and that is one thing that I found in my book is the ease with which a billionaire could decide to buy a house or, one case, I was with a guy in the book, and he decided to buy a Bentley. We drove by the showroom and just decided on the spur of the moment to buy a $200,000 Bentley. But when you mentioned in Aspen that millionaires are a dime a dozen, it really is true. The number of millionaire households in America has more than doubled over the past 10 years. There are now 9 million millionaire households in America, and there are 500,000 households worth $10 million or more. So to most people, $10 million sounds like a lot of money, but there are 500,000 households in America worth that amount. So when you're in this world of Richistan, you can be worth $10 million and see so many people worth so much more than you that you suddenly feel middle class, especially in a place like Aspen.
Yeah.
And, Rock, we hope every one of those half million homes has one of your paintings in it.
So do I. Thanks a lot.
Good luck, Rock. Thanks very much for the call. I wonder, Robert Frank, again, getting back to this demographic issue, I guess the assumption would be that the vast majority of those super rich people you're writing about would be Republicans as opposed to Democrats.
Well, that was my assumption when I went into this project. But what I actually found is that a growing number of today's wealthy are actually Democrats and what they call themselves progressives. And if you see what's happened with the amount of money the Democrats have raised in this recent election cycle versus the Republicans are suddenly panicked by the fact that so many of today's wealthy are moving toward the liberal, the Democratic side of the political spectrum, that the traditional party of wealth, the GOP, is suddenly trying to figure out, well, how do we recapture that audience? And there's a whole wave of progressive politics that is taking place within the multimillionaire population. I look at this group in Denver that single-handedly funded the 2004 elections in Denver and really turned that legislature from a Republican to a Democratic one. And the Republicans never expected it because they thought, well, the rich are all Republicans. And it's turning out to be much more complicated than that.
Does that suggest that at least a significant percentage of those people would be willing to pay more taxes?
What's fascinating is that they are, and not only in the interviews that I did, but also we're seeing very publicly Warren Buffett come out and say the rich should be paying more taxes. A billionaire bond trader named Bill Gross came out recently, said the wealthy should pay more taxes. I think really for self-preservations and sort of enlightened self-interest, today's wealthy are saying, look, inequality has gotten so large that we have to do something to mitigate it. Otherwise, the future of wealth in America could be in jeopardy.
We're talking today about the definition of rich and what you would have to make to consider yourself rich. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. When we come back, we'll be talking about attitudes of wealth among different racial groups. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about where we draw the line between middle class and wealth. What's your definition of rich? What would you need to make? What would you need to have in order to feel rich? 800-989-8255. Drop us an email, talk@npr.org. You can send us comments on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Here's some of them we've just received in the last few minutes. There are many stages of rich, writes Teresa, who listens to KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. For many, it would simply be the luxury of not worrying about whether or not you can afford that $20 dinner. For others, whether or not you can afford that $26,000 Prada purse. Rich is having more money than you need to pay the bills and buy nice things for yourself and your friends. Rich is having enough money to smile at your own good fortune. And she also says some nice things about this program. Here's another one, this one from Richard. I believe that anyone can live richly without necessarily being wealthy. It's a state of mind more than a size of your pocketbook. I'm lucky enough to consider myself upper middle class, but don't feel that that's necessarily made my life richer. In fact, my wife and I have to work so hard to maintain our financial lifestyle, it actually takes away from our real life. And quick question, does my IRA, which is my entire retirement fund, qualify as part of my net worth? If it does, I'm a millionaire, but I don't expect to be able to take more than $50,000 a year out of it. I've always wondered whether that was included in statistics like the top 6% have a net worth of $1 million or more. Well, let's ask our guest. He's Robert Frank, who writes the Wealth Report column for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of the book Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. We have a link to that excerpt from that book at npr.org/talk. And Robert Frank is with us from our bureau in New York. So Josephine's IRA, does that count as part of her net worth?
Yes, and not only does her IRA count as part of her net worth, but her house also adds to the net worth. So if you look at the number of millionaires that we've created over the past 10 years, A lot of it, I think, is due to the increase in real estate prices. And so those 9 million millionaire households, or those half million households worth 10 million or more, a lot of that is real estate and IRAs, which, let's face it, most people can't spend those every day. So they may be rich on paper, but they're not rich in their life.
And they may be less rich on paper today than they were yesterday.
Exactly.
Joining us now from her home in Maryland is Michelle Singletary, financial correspondent for The Washington Post and a personal finance contributor for NPR's Day to Day. Michelle, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you.
And I wonder, do ideas of wealth differ among different ethnic groups?
You know, I don't think so. In this country, because everything is defined a lot about how much stuff you have, I think for many groups, it's the same thing. You know, how big is your house? What kind of car do you drive? Can you send your kids to college? I mean, I think across the board, I think the feeling of that you're inadequate comes when you can't do all of those things. And most Americans can't. I thought it was really interesting, the last discussion about, you know, what is wealth, because we don't use those words correctly. There's net worth, and then there's the feeling that you're rich, and so you're living above your means. And to me, net worth doesn't necessarily include, I mean, technically it includes equity in your home, but we now see what that market is like, what the real estate market can do.
Yeah.
And a lot of that equity can be gone, you know, tomorrow. And so many people borrow what they thought was their wealth from their house, but was really somebody else's money.
And now they're going to have to come to terms with all of that. In terms of how people look at it, I would assume that the terms lower class and upper class for African Americans, for example, would have the same baggage that they do for white Americans.
Absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, more African Americans are lower income is the word I'd like to use.
Well, I said earlier, lower class is a term we hardly ever use.
Yeah, because it sort of makes it sound like you're, you know, ghetto.
Yeah, or low class.
You know, lower
yeah.
income. And, you know, the average or the median household income in the United States is still below $50,000. It's $48,200 according to the last data from the Census Bureau. So the vast majority of the country is still, you know, really literally, and literally I mean living paycheck to paycheck. When a family says I have $100,000 or $200,000, I'm just getting by, that's a lie. What it is that you can supply your needs. You just can't get all your needs and your wants.
It's interesting that $48,000 median income figure, that means half of Americans make more than that annually and half make less than that annually.
That's right.
And you double that and you're almost exactly at that $97,000
exactly right.
figure that Senators Clinton and Obama were arguing about.
Right, that's right. And, you know, it's interesting. There was a reporter for the Post, Michael Fletcher, who just did a column or article that found that nearly half of African Americans that were born to middle-income parents in the late 60s are now in poverty or near poverty status, which tells you how tenuous it is, this wealth that we think that we create for ourselves.
Or this idea that once a family starts moving upward, it continues on that path.
I think, yes, because new money tends to buy things as opposed to creating, you know, appreciable assets. You know, you talk to most families, most of their assets are in their home, and then the next big thing is their cars. We spend more on our cars than we do sending our kids to college because they're borrowing money to go to college. And so that's why it's so important that people, when we do these kind of segments, these shows, that, you know, people realize that you can't look at, you know, what other people are doing. You have to spend below your means to really, truly feel wealthy.
We borrow money to buy our cars, too.
Yeah, unfortunately so. I mean, it just the money we put in cars, and the moment you drive it off a lot, it depreciates. It's just mind-boggling to me. I mean, I keep my car until they push me off the road, and I'm on the first-name basis with the tow truck drivers because I want my net worth to truly be that. I don't count, you know, my equity. I look at the cash I have, the money I have in my retirement accounts, and the fact that I can be able to send my kids to college without them borrowing a dollar in debt.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Nancy. Nancy with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi.
Hi, Nancy.
Yeah, listen, I was just struck. I've been listening for a while. I was struck, and I agree with what this caller just said, or the guest. I'm not sure who she is.
It's Michelle Singletary, but go ahead.
Okay. I grew up fairly wealthy. I mean, really, my mother didn't work. We lived overseas as Americans. We had made beautiful homes, swimming pools, wonderful lifestyle. Then I came to the States to go to college. I got married, and I spent all my money at Neiman Marcus and Saks and always expected to live that way. My husband had a bankruptcy in the 80s, like a lot of people, And I was just, I really learned that wealth is a relative thing. You know, I drive a car now, we've since divorced, but I drive a car now, a 2001 Toyota Corolla that I bought at a rental company. And it's got 165,000 miles on it. I shop at Big Lots, the dollar store. And I tell you what, it's all a matter of perspective, because I'm very proud of the fact that my kids have all gone to college. The third one's about to graduate. I have student loans I need to pay back. I'm 57 years old, and I'm still working. But I hear these people talking, and it's like it's a relative thing. You know, if you're used to a certain level, if you're used to shopping at Neiman's and Saks, I mean, it's very, very hard to see until you lose everything. But that's not really essential. You can shop at Target. You can go to Kmart. It's not going to kill you. And for me, it was just a very difficult mental shift that I had to make. And when I made it, I realized, oh my gosh, what's important is I can provide health insurance for my kids. They can go to college. We're happy. We have what we need. We have enough to eat. We have a roof over our heads, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that our country, we're so spoiled that we don't realize that it's not all about the stuff you have.
I agree with your philosophy, and it's one that can help a lot. And by the way, congratulations on that last kid getting out of college. That's a real achievement.
Oh, thank you very much.
We appreciate it.
And by the way, I have to tell you, as a single parent earning $30,000 a year, barely making ends meet, my daughter went to Princeton, graduated from Princeton, and had unbelievable grants made available to her. So, you know, anybody who thinks, oh, we can't do it because we're poor or whatever, it's just a question of finding resources and believing that you can have whatever you want. Well, in this country, you can have whatever you want. You just have to find it, work for it.
Thanks very much for that call, Nancy. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Robert Frank, I wanted to ask you about that. There are a lot of people, though, who do measure their success in life by their income level or by their wealth level.
Well, there are. But the one fascinating point that was made by the previous two speakers is the whole issue of mobility. And people are uncomfortable with wealth in America because there's a perception that we have some aristocracy where the rich are getting richer and it's some fixed group that just keeps piling up more and more money while the rest of us are just, you know, treading water. But the reality is that mobility in this country is such that people are moving up into the ranks of the wealthy and, as we just heard, falling off the ranks of the wealthy to such a degree that wealth has become very fluid in America. And for those who fall off, that's a painful reality. But I was actually encouraged in doing all this research on the wealthy that, in fact, the wealthy were changing every year. If you look at the Forbes list every year, you know, they're about between 50 and 100 people change in that list. And I think that's a microcosm for what's happening in wealth in America, that people are moving up and off of the list quite rapidly. So everyone has a chance.
And Michelle Singletary, let me ask you, in his book, Robert Frank talked to all these unbelievably wealthy people and came to the conclusion that they, each of them, would feel wealthy if they made roughly twice what they already had. Is that a workable definition, do you think, of anybody at any income level? If you had twice what you had, you'd feel rich.
Absolutely. You know, Roper does this study where they look at people's definition of the good life, and it's always, if I make twice more what I made, and interestingly so, they put having a car and some other things ahead of having children as the definition of wealth. I mean, it's amazing how people define wealth. But you know, one Sunday my pastor asked that question, who among you consider yourselves rich? And I go to a very large church, and just a smattering of hands went up. My hand didn't go up. And then he began to tick off the things that really count as being rich. You know, who could decide what car to drive or what to wear, or how many of people had a clean drink of water, or who had three square meals? And he just started to tick off it, and I was embarrassed that I hadn't raised my hand, because you know, most of us are much wealthier than the rest of the world, and really there are certainly people in this country who it is not a matter of getting a car or sending your kid to school. You can't feed your children. There's a lot of people like that, but there are a lot of us who, if we put our needs first and take care of those and stop wanting more, we have people who have cell phones for their children and iPods and things like that and don't have a college fund for them, and then they cry the blues when it comes time to send their kids to college because they don't have any college money. But in the course of that child's 18 years, have had three or four cars, enough to send them to a very good state school. school. So I think we have to redefine what wealth is. Net worth is what you actually own. That doesn't mean the equity in your house, because that's not yours until you sell that home. So if we redefine that and look around, if you look in your house right now, if you're driving in your car and you appreciate the things that you have, you will define yourself as rich, and you won't be looking at the Jones thinking, I wish I had more.
Michelle Singletary is a financial correspondent for The Washington Post and a personal finance contributor for NPR's show Day to Day. Our other guest is Robert Frank, who writes the Wealth Report column for The Wall Street Journal and wrote the book Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's some email definitions. This one from Chris. One night over pizza and beer, my friends and I arrived at the following definition of rich. You're rich if you can fund your lifestyle without working. You're middle class if you can fund your lifestyle, but you have to work. You're poor if you can't fund your lifestyle, even if you do work. This from Arlene. Rich is when you can afford to throw out edible food from the table. Middle class always can put food on the table. Poor when you worry about putting food on the table and make food purchases based on the money available or money not available. This from Mary, she calls herself, in South Carolina. To me, if you can afford to hire a cleaning lady or a landscaper, you're rich. And Robert Frank, I think domestic help was one of the definitions.
That's right. I mean, you know, wealth is really relative and positional. So, for instance, I interviewed a guy who we were on his 100-foot yacht, and we were looking around the marina at boats that were two and three times as large as his 100-foot yacht. And he said, you know, this boat today, it's like a dinghy compared to these other boats. And he felt – I wouldn't say he felt poor, but he didn't feel rich because we were looking at boats that were two and three times as large. People who have household staff – there's one guy – I talked to in the book, and I asked him how many household staff he had at his house in California. And he said, well, it's probably around 60 or 70. And that took a while to sink in. And then his wife came over and said, no, I just counted yesterday. It's 105. So imagine having 105 people working in your house.
And losing track of half of them.
And not knowing their names or even what they do. And so for people who think, well, household staff is a big deal, and maybe they've hired a maid and maybe they've hired a butler, they're looking up to the guy with 105 household staff thinking, wow, you know, I'm just a dinghy in this world of super yachts. And so it's lovely, and it is comforting and important to know that we should all be grateful for what we have. But the fact is, wealth is based on what we see around us every day. And for the wealthy, they see people with so much more money and so much more stuff than they do that they've actually convinced themselves that they're not wealthy.
Let's talk to Menish. Menish is with us from Baltimore in Maryland.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, thank you.
I'm calling from the perspective, I'm a medical student right now, and I'll be graduating soon, and I've noticed this issue of perspective on wealth keeps coming up, like you consider yourself rich based on your perspective of others. And I noticed this in the medical community, where the family practice doctor is saying, oh, that cardiologist down the street is richer than I am, and the cardiologist complaining the orthopedic surgeon down the street is richer than he is. And I think it's interesting that...
And they all look down on the medical student, of course.
Well, exactly. Well, for a variety of reasons, people look down on the medical student. But I think that it's interesting because, especially in the medical community, we work directly with people and for people who are significantly poorer than we are. And so I think it's interesting that we look at the perspective of those that are in our fields but not really realize that, you know, 50, 60 people come into our clinics every single day. Most of them are significantly poorer than we are. But yet we still have this sense of, oh, we're poor. And I think that that's very unique to industries like medicine, maybe law, where you deal with patients or clients who are not well off and yet still have this ability to say, I'm poor, I can't afford this, that, or the other, like the guy down the street.
So like Robert Frank's using the yacht measurement, they might be measuring the size of the Lexus in the parking lot in the hospital.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's a real pitfall, because at the end of the day, I think having a good perspective on what you have and being able to understand that what you have is valuable makes you really a capable and competent, in my particular field, a capable and competent physician, because you're able to understand that the service you provide and the amount of money that you get for it is invaluable to people who may or may not be able to afford it.
All of which suggests, and Menish, first of all, good luck with your studies, and thanks for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
But it all suggests that perhaps we would all be well advised to every once in a while go see how the other half lives so that we stop using our own narrow definitions of what wealth is and how we compare ourselves to our neighbors or our colleagues and see really what other people are doing. It's really an interesting issue. Michelle Singletary, wish we had more time to talk. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. And I just want to add quickly, a lot of African-Americans already know how the other half lives. Many of them who are middle or upper income are helping family members who are lower income. So we know both sides of that road.
Michelle Singletary, financial correspondent for The Washington Post, also a contributor to NPR's Day to Day. Robert Frank, we appreciate talking to you again.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Robert Frank writes the Wealth Report column for The Wall Street Journal, and his book is Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom. Up next, what it might take to see progress at this week's Mideast Peace Summit. A former Middle East negotiator joins us on the opinion page. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.